Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Some economy news this morning. The government reports jobs in the U.S. went up by a solid 235,000 workers in the month of February, and the unemployment rate fell even lower than it was to 4.7%. And average hourly earnings are up a little bit, 0.2%, but it's good when wages tick up a little bit. By the looks of these numbers and the stock market so far, fears of market jitters because of the uncertainty of the unpredictable new president have yet to materialize. Joining me now to help make sense of this is Adam Davidson, none other than the co-founder of NPR's Planet Money. And Adam has an article in this week's New Yorker, Donald Trump's Worst Deal, which takes a look at some of Trump's questionable international business deals. Hi, Adam. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. So good to be back.
So let's start on the jobs numbers. First jobs report that falls squarely under Trump's presidency. Does it tell you anything?
I mean, it tells me that we're, you know, still in a fairly robust period of economic growth that's been going on for quite some time.
And the last year of Obama was having 200,000 plus most of the months, right?
It's something we've been saying, unfortunately, since 2009, that, for the last several years, we would have wanted to see 300, 400, 500,000 new jobs each month to dig out of the hole we were in. And so these numbers are simultaneously really great and better than they've been in a long time and not quite enough, although we're pretty much in a full recovery at this point. I want to say the obvious. There is nothing that President Trump has done, good or bad, that would impact these numbers. I mean, jobs numbers are, you know, these are macroeconomic indicators that indicate, you know, Federal Reserve policy, all sorts of issues that do not have a, like, week-by-week, month-by-month impact from the president.
How about the stock market jumping as much as it has, though, since the election? That might have a more direct relationship because of the speculative nature of the stock market. This is what people think is going to happen in the future. So is there a Trump bump as far as you can tell?
Oh, there definitely is, although I don't know that it means necessarily good news. I think, stocks, when the stock market goes up overall for an extended period of time, you know, it's important to ask, like, well, what is that telling us? Sometimes that is telling us that investors as a group on average believe that the economy overall is going to grow dramatically and healthily in the future, and so I'm going to make more money for investing today. That certainly was probably what the market was generally telling us in the good years of the 1950s and 1960s. But another thing that can be telling you is investors, you know, we think of them as capital. They own the capital stock, will get that we will continue the overall transfer of wealth from labor to capital. That's a process that has been going on certainly since the late 1970s, where, you know, it used to be that labor had a much larger share of economic growth. And, Donald Trump's policies, reducing taxes on the wealthy, reducing regulation on businesses, et cetera, are all things, and, you know, this healthcare bill and on, are all things that are in the most explicit way that we've seen, you know, probably since the George W. Bush tax cuts, a transfer of wealth from labor to capital, basically from working people to rich people. And I know your listeners might be thinking, hey, wait, I have money in the stock market. But 90% of the wealth of the money in the stock market is you know, a tiny, you know, 1 or 2% or even less of the population. You know, you and me who have our 401ks or 403bs are, you know, all of us, the whole, you know, 200 million of us or whatever, represent 10% of the stock market. We're a very small component of that. So I think, you know, we've, for whatever reason that I find very frustrating, we as a nation have long decided that the stock market is an indicator of overall economic health. I would say that's only true in special circumstances and has not been true for decades.
And that's exactly what led to the Occupy movement and the rise of the sort of income inequality as a central organizing principle of Democratic Party politics. The fact that since the Great Recession, we've had steady economic growth, but not wage growth. So it comes out to what you very clearly described as a transfer of wealth from labor to capital. And I'm just curious, Adam, if you've thought about it in these terms, how you see this Trump policy that's emerging on the economy as consistent with Steve Bannon's economic nationalism. Because in theory, economic nationalism is concerned with the workers, right? That's why they're putting pressure on immigration so that there isn't as much competition. Whether or not the theory is accurate, that's the politics of it. If you have fewer immigrants, then American workers are going to have higher wages because the labor market is more competitive, and pressure on these companies not to move jobs overseas. Same thing, to benefit the American worker. There's a nationalist pro-worker labor fervor. The AFL-CIO has made some friendly noises since the inauguration, things like that. And yet, with their relationship with the conservatives in Congress, they come up with this big tax cut proposal and this big health reform proposal, which is going to take a lot of working class people off of health insurance. So I'm curious if you see either politically or just economically tension within what I think Steve Bannon might want different from what's going on, this sort of European style big government economic nationalism.
So, yeah, and I have actually read a fair bit and listened to speeches by Steve Bannon to try and understand his vision of economics. And something I want to say, which I think a lot of people would know this, but, you know, just because you have a philosophy like Steve Bannon does doesn't mean it makes any sense or is a reasonable philosophy. And I'd say his is in and of itself self-contradictory and confusing and weird. One thing he is honest about, which I appreciate, the honesty, not the idea, is that he thinks economic growth and economic success is a tool of his self-defined enemy, the globalists. And he has said explicitly that he recognizes that his policies may make us poorer and may make Americans poorer, but he values, you know, his vague and upsetting ideas about our culture and our nationalhood, you know, and I think it's fairly clear that means, you know, American-born white. I don't think we want to talk about his concern about the overall working class. There's very little evidence that extends beyond American-born white people. But he at least is explicit about that. And I think, you know, William F. Buckley Jr. famously, through National Review in the 1950s, 1960s, set the groundwork for Ronald Reagan, and this has been, you know, highly covered. The idea that there was sort of a bunch of diffuse elements within the Republican Party, there was a sort of business country club type that didn't really care about ideology. They just wanted to, you know, make money and have success, and probably had some vague feeling that Milton Friedman was smart and markets should be free so long as they're not so free that it hurts their business. And then there was the John Birch Society, kind of nativist, racist, anti-Semitic part of the Republican Party. And then there was, you know, the anti-communists I remember someone enumerating five different wings of the Republican Party. And Ronald Reagan somehow magically created this, you know, that brought them all together and made them all think, oh, even though we wildly disagree on so many issues, we kind of agree on this one issue. Yeah. And I think that tension is opened up again in a very interesting way. And I expect it to be with us for a long time, long after Donald Trump is no longer president and Steve Bannon is no longer in the White House. I think I don't think these are compatible in any fundamental way. And I think Steve Bannon's ultimate goal is to destroy Paul Ryan. I mean, he has made that very clear. He hates Paul Ryan and he hates his views. So there seems to be somehow the two sides have convinced each other that they at least want us to think they're working together, but their goals are so fundamentally different. It's going to be fascinating to watch.
Well, for the
it's destructive.
For the moment, they're stuck with each other because they each got elected through different kinds of coalitions. But let me just follow up on one thing that you said that I hadn't heard before, which is that Bannon thinks that the country might have to become poorer to become better. I thought that he thought that the country, at least that white working class, could become richer under his policies after all this, you know, slow growth since the recession hit 8 years ago, and after all this globalism that took a lot of manufacturing jobs out of the country. What is it about making us poorer that he said?
So part of this is, I think he's been, you know, he is careful not to say it as bluntly as I'm saying it, but I don't see any other interpretation. So part of it is that, you know, white working class people have had, in his mind, there's no evidence for this, actually the contrary is clearly true, but in his mind, white working class Americans born in America have had their wealth taken from them by immigrants, by minorities, by others. And so...
And by globalizing corporate chieftains,
and by globalizing,
right?
Corporations, and you know, wealthy people in New York, and obviously we know what that means. So it is possible that in his mind he will enrich, in his mind, real Americans, and just make the others poorer, or in his mind, take away their ill-gotten gains, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But he has made clear that economic growth as a goal in and of itself is, in his mind, part of the globalist agenda. So the very idea that we talk about GDP growth and other things as a sign of the health of our country, he considers wrong, and he's made that very clear, that a culture is represented, you know, he's talked about symphonies and architecture and grand projects. So I think the critique that, for example, the infrastructure bill that Trump proposes, that I think many Democrats are incorrectly trying, you know, Bernie Sanders and others are very horribly trying to embrace, I think for my sense is for Steve Bannon, it's not, oh, great, that'll put people to work, it'll create jobs. It's more, we're going to have proud, I mean, I hate to say it, I don't know what else to say, proud Nazi-like architectural projects, big new highways, other things that show the state is great and our nation is great and we have these great, exciting, cultural projects built in Greek and Latin culture, and I mean Greek and Roman culture, not Latin, the opposite of Latin culture. And I meant Roman. Mm-hmm. And I think that that will be extremely costly with very little benefit overall. So it's a radical, you know, he is a radical departure from anything like republicanism of the last, you know, 40, 35 years, whatever, since Reagan.
Wow. You went further with that and have thought about this more than I realized you had. So that was really interesting.
Me too, Brian. I didn't realize I felt so strongly about it.
My guest is Adam Davidson, co-founder of NPR's Planet Money, and he has an article in this week's New Yorker, Donald Trump's Worst Deal, which, now that you were so generous and give me prologue on things that I was interested in, let's get to your very interesting article. What is Donald Trump's Worst Deal?
Well, you know, to be totally honest, I'm not sure I did get his worst deal. There might be worse ones, but although I like the headline. So this is an article about the deal he struck in Baku, Azerbaijan, which is, you know, for people who don't know, Azerbaijan is a small independent country that was a Soviet republic, one of the poorest, most ignored Soviet republics, sort of nestled between Iran and Russia, and considered one of the most corrupt countries in the world, a country that was, you know, deeply impoverished until it found oil, and then was just enmeshed in the most blatant and ugly forms of corruption that you would expect in a post-Soviet oil-rich state. And but even given all that, the Trump Tower Baku was one of the most blatantly corrupt projects in a very blatantly corrupt country. Donald Trump partnered, or the Trump Organization partnered with a family called the Mammadovs, which are famously among the most corrupt people in one of the most corrupt countries. And the more I learned about them and the more I learned about this deal, the more just completely shocked I was by the irresponsibility of it, the riskiness of it. Leave aside the morality of working with corrupt people or just the business, the nonsensical business decision of partnering with such sketchy people. I to this day, even though I've spent the last several months thinking of little else, I am very confused as to why they ever thought this was a good idea.
We have to take a break, but when we come back, I want you to talk about how you think this fits into a larger context of Trump's business empire and if there are any implications for United States policy or Americans who, you know, may experience economic gains or losses as a result of this deal in Azerbaijan. And listeners, you can ask a few questions of Adam Davidson, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Adam Davidson, co-founder of NPR's Planet Money and author of an article in The New Yorker this week, Donald Trump's Worst Deal, about the Trump International Hotel and Tower in Baku, Azerbaijan, in a corrupt environment there, as he was explaining before the break. And Adam, a main question your article tries to answer is whether or not the Trump Organization is actually in violation of the law, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act of 1977. What's that?
The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, it makes it a crime to for an American business or even a foreign business that has extensive dealings in America to bribe a foreign official or in any way, you know, benefit a foreign official for to benefit from that foreign official. So, it's a fascinating story, which I don't think we have time to go into in great detail. But it actually came out of Watergate and some of the investigations into Watergate, and it has completely transformed how business is generally conducted in America, and I would argue has transformed it for the better. Nearly all companies in America that do business overseas have a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act compliance program. It's a fairly standard thing. You could call it any big white-collar law firm, any big accounting firm, and just say, hey, I'm thinking of doing some business in Azerbaijan or India or whatever. I need some due diligence done. And it's very standard, very easy to do. And basically, you want to make sure you're not accidentally, inadvertently doing business with corrupt officials who are using their corruption to benefit you or the project. And the system works by a series of red flags. What are warning signs about a deal? And in this deal, we have that the deal is in Azerbaijan. That is considered in and of itself a red flag. Azerbaijan is known to be a highly corrupt nation. It is a deal with the family of the sitting transportation minister. That's considered a big red flag when you're doing business with the family of a transportation minister. His brother, who actually signed the contract with the Trump Organization, was a sitting member of parliament. That's a big red flag. And then the family was known to have close ties to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. That's about as big as red flags go. But when you combine them all, doing business in one of the most corrupt nations in the world with the family of one of the most corrupt people in that country who have ties to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, it is impossible to imagine a more dangerous deal to do. So, and to this day, I have not gotten a satisfactory answer. Why in the world would they have thought this was a good idea?
So you raise the question in the article, did the Trump Organization do its due diligence before knowingly engaging in business with corrupt state actors with potential ties to sponsors of terrorist organizations? Or did they not do it? Or did they do it and decide to look the other way to make a buck? How close to an answer to that question can you come?
So I should say the Trump Organization has repeatedly told me that we did all relevant due diligence and it did not raise any red flags. Now, that is not a credible statement because, as I said, simply doing business in Azerbaijan is a red flag. So there is no way that a recognized due diligence process would not raise red flags. Lots of deals raise red flags, by the way, that are still done because you learn how to mitigate the risk. Mm-hmm. You monitor the money. You make 100% sure that no corrupt activity is involved in the project. You know, there are ways of doing business, even with corrupt people, and not violate the law. But they didn't do any of that. So I don't know. They wouldn't show me what due diligence they did. They wouldn't even confirm that they still have it. So I have no idea if they did due diligence, but hired a firm that was so bad or so willing to look the other way that it didn't find anything, or if they did due diligence and it found lots of things and they decided to do the deal anyway, or if they just simply didn't do due diligence at all. I don't know.
You even have Trump on the record criticizing the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act as a matter of policy. So how far do you go with that? Does that suggest that he thinks American companies need to be able to pay some bribes if they're doing business in a corrupt overseas environment?
He explicitly says that.
Really?
On CNBC in May of 2012, he explicitly says that the only way to do business in other countries is to bribe foreign officials. And we had a conversation about whether or not we could consider that a confession of having paid bribes, because he's saying the only way to do deals is that way, and he's done deals. So, but, you know, he didn't say, I myself have paid bribes, although I feel like the implication seems fairly clear. So it's a shocking statement for a business person to say. I mean, just let's say you are paying bribes. Why would you go on TV and basically say that you pay bribes?
Right. But is
it president to have said it?
Yes.
So,
but to have said it before he was in office, I presume.
Fair enough.
And I imagine for you as a business reporter who's sophisticated about the world, a lot of business people who do business overseas, you know, depending on the country, will say, yeah, you got to grease the palms a little in this place and you got to do it in that place.
You know what, Brian? That's not true. I mean, there are very corrupt countries where corruption is endemic. We know that. Azerbaijan, Haiti, you know, we can have a long list. There's no question. But American, and I would say in the 50s, 60s, 70s, into the 80s, American companies were basically what they would typically do is hire a local agent and pay them a lot more than would be appropriate and then just assume the agent was paying bribes. And it was fairly normal.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my grandfather being very proud that when he did business in Europe in the 60s, he didn't pay bribes. And it was like this defiant stand that he had as an American businessman. But by the 90s, that stopped being the norm.
Huh.
And today, the Trump Organization's activity is an extreme outlier. It is very unusual for a company to be this reckless. And that is not for moral reasons. I don't want to suggest that, you know, American businesses are just run by a bunch of moral, you know, necessarily run by people who, you know, that is for simple good business sense. The fines, the prosecution, the reputational damage of doing business in corrupt nations are really damaging. Also, as many company executives have told me, the process of doing due diligence and risk management, that's just good business. You know, it's not like some extra expense. I mean, basically what you're doing is trying to figure out if the people you're partnering with are trustworthy, if the project itself will make money, if there are unseen risks in doing a deal. And that's just what business people should be doing, even if there was no law outlawing bribery. So I think Americans do have this impression that, oh, corruption's endemic. It just happens. You look the other way. That is not true. That is not true. This is outlying, dangerous, kind of bizarre behavior.
Anthony in Yonkers. You're on WNYC with Adam Davidson. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Brian. It's nice to be on again. I just wonder, how are these other countries, you know, he said that America's prospering, but what about Greece and Spain and Puerto Rico? You know, why are they in austerity? Why can't they why don't they have any prosperity? And the second part is, isn't any of this growth tied to President Obama's 8 years? Any of it? I mean, you said it, I know it's not Donald Trump, but Isn't it possible that some of this is President Obama's work?
Anthony, thank you. So there's really two questions in there. One is about the countries that have debt crises, plus Puerto Rico as a U.S. territory with a debt crisis. Let me ask you in our limited time to focus on Anthony's second question, which is about the rate of economic growth, which has been, you know, steady but sluggish under President Obama. And Trump and all the other Republicans who were running for president were saying, what are you kidding? 1-2% growth? We can get back to the good old days of 3-4% growth and grow our way out of the national debt and the Social Security and Medicare pressures and all this stuff. But does anybody believe it?
No, I think President Obama was a very good steward of the economy. And you know, to the extent the president can influence the economy, I don't think it's an issue that was economic growth was not central to his concerns. I think stability and getting back to decent, robust growth was central. And I think he did a good job, hamstrung by an uncompliant Congress and, you know, the worst financial conditions in human history. So, of course, he gets credit for that.
But one of the central organizing principles of the Paul Ryan Congress, and with Trump now in tow, is that Obamacare placed a lot of downward pressure on growth because of its burdens on businesses.
That's absurd. And that is completely dismissed by every economist.
Along with the growth of regulation.
Yeah, it's there's not even anything to purchase on. I mean, find me even a Republican economist who can actually make that argument with evidence and data and thought. It's an absurd, either ideological or political point that's not worth serious conversation.
All right.
Brian, I'm not like a knee-jerk Democrat.
I know from talking to you over the years that you and I have even gone back and forth a little bit on liberal economics versus more conservative economics, and you are not politically correct. You know, you are not in any knee-jerk way politically correct in your history. So I'm just giving you that that cred. So as we run out of time, on your article, is it just another story of, oh, God, what a person this Donald Trump is? Or are there any implications here for the American people writ large?
Well, you know, you're talking to the guy who wrote the story and spent 3 months of it. So, of course, I don't feel it's just another story. I think that the implications are, you know, the immediate implications are, there needs to be a thorough investigation of this man's business connections around the world. I mean, if I, as a reporter, spending 3 months with no access to subpoena power or intelligence tools, was able to uncover a connection to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, then what else is out there? And we need to know what else is out there. That is crucial. Number two, I would say this tells us that for all the conversations we've had about him, for all the reporting we've done, there's a lot out there we don't know. This is one of dozens of deals. You know, luckily I'm at The New Yorker. I have the opportunity to spend several months researching it. But what will happen, and it will happen, when we reporters and other investigators dig into the dozens of other deals? My expectation is I will not be able to call this Donald Trump's worst deal, and we're going to find out a lot more about his connections around the world, and I don't think that will be good news for the Trump Organization or the Trump administration.
Adam Davidson is co-founder of NPR's Planet Money, and his article in this week's New Yorker is titled, at least for the moment, Donald Trump's Worst Deal. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.